Hi, I'm Simon Jones, and you're listening to the Writers' Centre Norwich podcast with the first of our author events from the Norwich Crime Writing Festival. Peter James is the best-selling author of over 25 books, including the Roy Grace series, as well as a film producer and digital literature pioneer. There was a packed audience at Peter's event, which was hosted by Gerald in the heart of Norwich. This is a recording of the entire event, during which Peter shares writing advice, his experiences of shadowing the police while researching his books, and reads the opening of his latest book, Love You Dead.
Hi everyone, can you hear me okay? It's quite a warm evening, so I'll do my best to cool you down. Over the next short while. So I'm going to talk a little bit about myself and my writing, and then I'm going to read a short passage from Love You Dead, and then I'll throw it open to questions. It was rather ironic that when I was a child growing up in Brighton in the 50s and 60s, it was a rather seedy, tatty place. Noel Coward rather dismissively said, "Ah, dear Brighton, peers, queers, and racketeers." And it was the late Keith Waterhouse who said, "You know, Brighton has the air of a town that is perpetually helping the police with their inquiries." Very fortunately for me, not much has changed. Some of you may have read in the newspaper about 4 years ago of a rather horrible murder, which took place on the golf course at the dike near Brighton. And a charred body was discovered around midday on Sunday morning, just by the 18th green. It really messed up a lot of people's golf round that morning, because they were arguing about whether it was a movable obstruction or a free drop. But I was rather flattered to get an email from a young detective constable who said a couple of days into the inquiry, he'd been on a bus and he heard these two old ducks sitting behind him saying, "Oh, isn't it terrible? Isn't it terrible?" And one said, "It's just like something out of a Peter James novel." But you know, it can be a very ego-bruising business to be an author. A writer friend of mine was on a train a while back, and he saw a woman sitting opposite him reading one of his books. And there is always that moment when that happens, when you think, do I say something, do I keep quiet? Anyway, he sat there for 20 minutes, and she was turning the pages. So he finally said, "Excuse me," he said, "that's my book." And she went, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, I found it here." And she closed it up and handed it back to him and said, "Actually, I wasn't really enjoying it anyway." You know, it's so easy to misunderstand and misinterpret so much in life. I remember when I was a kid, seeing on television or hearing on the radio about some dreadful crime. Then the reporter would say, "And a man is helping the police with their inquiries." In my naivety, I used to think, gosh, isn't it nice? There's so many kind and helpful people in the world. A big turning point in my life was when I was 14. I read Graham Greene's Brighton Rock. And that book had an extraordinary impact on me, because I put it down and I just vowed to myself right then and there that one day I would try and write a crime novel set in Brighton that was 10% as good as that book. What was extraordinary to me at that time was this was a book that broke all the rules of the crime writing genre. Up until that point, there were very strict sort of structures. Graham Greene just threw that out the window. He began with, I think, one of the most gripping opening lines in all of fiction. "Within 3 hours of arriving in Brighton, Hale knew they meant to murder him." Secondly, its central character is this 17-year-old gangster, Pinky, who's a murderer and yet a devout Catholic, terrified of eternal damnation. And thirdly, it has an incredibly dark ending. And not really the kind of the baddies all getting locked up. Who's read the book? All of you, I guess, are here because you love the crime fiction genre. I do urge you, buy it from Gerald, support the independents. You won't regret it. I reread this book every few years, and it just still holds up. It doesn't have a mobile phone in it. Doesn't have DNA, but it's just got the most wonderful characters. It's still one of the richest books I think ever written. I had a long journey to becoming a crime writer. I wrote a number of different kinds of thrillers. I was very wary of the UK crime writing culture. I guess following very much in the steps of Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, all the Golden Age authors, I felt there were certain rigid rules and conventions you absolutely had to adhere to. Combining a little bit of a murder, country house setting, a little bit of culture, a little bit of religion, frisson of sex. So I came up with what I thought was the perfect opening line that would encompass all of these. And yet, because you have to begin a crime novel in the old English tradition with a dead body in a library of a country house. So this is the line I wrote. Fuck me, I've been shot. Said the vicar's wife. As her knickers hit the library floor of Ponsonby Towers with a crash. I have so far spared everyone from this line, but I promise one day. I had a kind of, my first writing job, the first thing I ever got published was a true story I sent to Private Eye magazine in 1966, for which I got paid the princely sum of 10 shillings. And looking around this room, I don't see many of you as old as me in here, but there may be a few of you who remember what 10 shillings was. Probably 50 pence in today's money, but a value of maybe 10 quid. And the story I sent them was a story I came across about an American inventor called Reuben Tice, who decided that more people would eat prunes if they weren't wrinkled. So he built a steam compressor to de-wrinkle prunes. And he was decapitated when the machine exploded. I went to film school, and I came out of film school in 1970, and it was really hard to get a job in the UK, and I went out to Canada where I had an uncle, and I got a job as a gopher on a daily program for preschool children called Polka Dot Door. A gopher is the lowest human life form on a television set. You literally go for this, go for that. And I'd been there about 3 months, and the producer came in a panic one day and said, the writer's sick, we haven't got a show today. I just read your CV. You won your Charterhouse Poetry Prize. Could you write today's show? So I kind of sat in a corner with an IBM Selectric golf ball, and I wrote this show. And I ended up, it turned out to be a great break. I ended up writing it 3 days a week for the next year, and I was 22 years old. But I was thinking, you know, if it was a really good break, I'd be in Hollywood working with beautiful actresses, not stuck in the coldest city on the planet with five bad-tempered puppets. I then graduated to making movies. I started making low-budget horror films with such classy titles as Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, I Dismembered Mama, Blood Orgy of the She-Devils. I then went on and I wrote a comedy called Spanish Fly, which starred Terry Thomas and Leslie Phillips, which the film critic Barry Norman gave the accolade of being the worst British film since the Second World War, and probably the least funny British funny film ever made. I did in my kind of movie writing and producing career make some films I was proud of. The one I am most proud of was Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino. She obviously didn't like it. My interest in the police began back in 1981. I'd had my first novel published, which was a not that great spy thriller called Dead Letter Drop. And I'd recently got married, and we got burgled. And I can strongly recommend getting burgled to any newlywed, because it gives you the perfect excuse to explain why all those horrible ornaments you've been given aren't on display. Yeah, auntie, that porcelain donkey with the quartz clock in its stomach, yeah, they took it. Apologies to anyone who likes their porcelain donkey with the quartz clock in its stomach. But a young detective came to take fingerprints, and he saw my book, and he said, oh, if you ever want any research help with the police, give me a call. And he was married to a detective. My then wife and I became friendly with them. They invited us firstly to a police boxing fight, then to a social night at Brighton Police Station, and to a barbecue at their house. And almost all of their friends who I started meeting were also police officers. Everything from crime scene investigators, traffic officers, response officers, neighborhood policing team, homicide detectives, divers. And I found talking to these people absolutely fascinating. And I started to realize, just from the conversations, that nobody sees more of human life in a 30-year career than a cop. And over the course of the next decade, as they realized I was genuinely interested, they'd start inviting me out, spend a day with them out on patrol, in their office. It got to a point where they'd allow me to go to crime scenes, and they'd even phone me up if they're going on a raid. And I just started thinking, I hadn't ever planned to be a crime writer per se. I wanted to write because I'm fascinated in the human condition, why people do the things that they do. But I started realizing just from the time I was spending out what an incredibly rich seam for a writer their work was. And just to give you a snapshot of a 12-hour shift I did recently with the duty inspector at Brighton and Hove, 7 o'clock in the morning we're called to a cot death, which is the biggest tragedy a young couple can have. There was a 3-month-old baby died during the night. The police have to give pastoral care. It's an incredibly difficult situation for them. But at the same time, they've got to be mindful that maybe the parents murdered this baby. So it's also a crime scene at the same time. Very difficult kind of balance. An hour later, we're called, 999 called by a woman who says her live-in boyfriend's just put dog shit in her mouth. An hour and a half after that, an elderly couple who've just been swindled out of their life savings by a cybercrime fraud. And then an hour on, a Turkish student's hit by a bus in the middle of Brighton. The paramedics think he's going to die. His girlfriend doesn't speak a word of English. They've got to find a translator for her. Luckily, the guy did survive, and he was okay. And the day just goes on. And in 1995, I was introduced to a man who's become a really central part of my writing life and also my personal life too, a guy called Dave Gaylor, who was a young detective inspector in Brighton. And there was a police officer said, I think you might quite like meeting this guy. And I was writing psychological thrillers at that time, which had quite a few of them had a police element. And I always remember going to this office. And I've never seen such a tip in my life. It was just blue and green plastic crates all over the floor, bulging with manila folders, and this guy's head just visible at the back. I said, oh, are you moving? He said, no, these are my dead friends. I thought, great, I've met the only weirdo in Sussex CID. And he then explained, he said, I am a homicide detective, but I've also been tasked with reopening all the unsolved murders in the county. Every one of these crates contains a principal case file of an unsolved murder. I am the last, and I've been asked to apply the latest advances in fingerprint technology and DNA to see if we can move these forward.
Ladies and gentlemen, the store is now closed. Thank you for shopping at Jarrell's, and we wish you a safe journey home.
I haven't bought anything. I'll buy a book. And Dave said, you know, I am the last chance each of these victims has for justice and that their families have for closure. And I loved that really kind of human image about him. He said, what are you writing at the moment? And I was working on a novel then called Denial, and he said, tell me about it. So I started talking him through the book, and I was about halfway through it. He said, hang on a sec, your character wouldn't have done that, and why hasn't your detective done this? And why hasn't he got an outside inquiry team doing that? And I realized this guy had a really creative side to him. And it's something that I've learned subsequently about good homicide detectives. And I think so often on television, they are portrayed as kind of arrogant, bolshy, intransigent people. And it's just not my experience. I've met many over the years, not just in the UK, but in the States and Australia and many other countries around the world. I try in my travels on book promotion to meet police wherever I go. And the qualities of a really good homicide detective are a very rare combination of two factors. One is that they are incredibly anal. You know, every major crime is a huge puzzle of hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces that have been meticulously put together. But so often, major crimes are solved by just complete lateral, out-of-the-box thinking. And the really good detectives have that unique combination of the two. And another quality, which is to have a completely open mind. And I've, in Dead Simple, in the first Roy Grace book, he gets into trouble in court for having gone to a medium. But I've met a number of detectives here and abroad who say, if all else fails in an inquiry and a psychic phones up who sounds credible, they'd be derelict in their duty not to at least to follow it through to some extent. Not that many crimes get solved through them, but Roy Grace had that kind of open mind that Dave Gaylor has. And Dave and I became friends, and he rose through the ranks and became, in by 2001, head of major crime for Sussex, Detective Chief Superintendent. And it was at the time my publishers asked if I'd ever consider creating a detective as a central character. So I went to Dave Gaylor and I said, would you like to be a fictional cop? And he loved the idea. He is my real life Roy Grace. We work very closely together on every book. He's become a very close friend. When Laura and I got married last year, he was my best man, and we sit down. When I'm writing a book, he reads every 100 pages. We talk about how Roy Grace would think and act as a real cop would, and helps to give me that authenticity that I try so hard to get in my writing. I think that the police have a very unfairly bad public image these days, and I think we've had seriously anti-police government, and there's no question that there have been a number of police officers over the years who've behaved in an extremely bad way, and a number of police forces have behaved in a really bad way too. But it's very easy to forget just what being a good police officer is, and almost every cop I've ever met at some point in his or her career has had their life on the line. They're not highly paid. They are people who can really and genuinely make a difference. And they are feeling very beleaguered. I think this current government is probably the most anti-police government we've ever had, slashing budgets, and I think doing a great deal of harm to crime prevention in the UK. Just to give you a snapshot of how the police are feeling sometimes, I was in Islington last year, out with two Met officers, a sergeant and a young detective. And the sergeant was limping. And I said to him, "Well, you hurt your foot?" He said, "Yeah, it was last year." He said, "Actually, just here." And he pointed at a bank across the road. He said, we were on patrol, just driving here. And these three blokes ran out that bank with our masks over their faces. Didn't look good to us. See, you can never accuse Plod of not being smart. So we leapt out of the car and yelled, "Stop, police." One of them turned around with a machine pistol, pointed it at us. We hit the deck and the three of them ran off. And he said, I'm not having this. So I got up and we ran on after them. And I again shouted, "Stop, police." And they split three ways. He said, rather stupidly, I went after the one with the gun. Chased him down this side street. He stopped, turned back round, aimed a gun at me, pointed at the pavement, pulled the trigger. The bullet bounced off the pavement, went into my right knee. He said, I was rolling round in the worst pain I've ever been in my life. 2 days later, a rather smartly dressed elderly lady walked into Islington Police Station and said, I wish to make a complaint about a police officer using foul language. It was pointed out to her that this officer had just been shot in the knee whilst bravely unarmed chasing a man with a machine gun. Yes, but that's all very well. There was no need for him to have used profanities, was there? Murder intrigues us all. It's the only crime for which there is no possible restitution. You rob somebody, you can pay back some or all of it. You kill somebody, you take their life. You can never give that back to them, and you've also destroyed the lives of their loved ones forever. The majority of killers are male, but also female killers have always fascinated me. I do quite a lot of talks in prisons. One of the charities that I'm involved with is the Reading Agency, which tries to encourage literacy. And the terrible tragedy is that in our prisons in the UK, the average reading age is 9 years old. And it's quite interesting. In men's prisons, they're categorized A, B, C, D. So you get kind of terrorists and the most dangerous people in the category A down to open prisons, mainly for sort of fraud, but also lifers who are slowly getting adjusted to going back into freedom. Women's prisons, they lump them all together. And they tend to sit in groups. So you'll get a group of like 18 to 25-year-old women who are all the sex workers. Then you get another group of sort of 20 to 40-year-olds, and they're the drug dealers. Then you get a group of 40 to 60-year-olds, and they're the husband killers. And I was giving a talk about 4 years back now in a woman's prison, and there was this one woman sitting among the husband killers who was clearly smarter than the average and asking very bright questions about literature. So I thought, I must find out what you're in for. And for me, the big bang in doing these talks is, apart from trying to help with the literacy, is getting a chance to mingle and talk to the inmates afterwards. So I make my way up to her afterwards, and you never say, what have you done? Sort of not etiquette. So I said, how much longer do you have to go? And she goes, 9.5 more bloody years. And it's just not fair. Woman did exactly what I did in London. She's only got 6 years to go. I said, what brought you in here? Well, I poisoned my mother-in-law, the old bag. It's like, okay. Well, thing was, she went in a hospital to die, so I embezzled her bank account. Bloody woman didn't die, came back home. Realized she'd find out, decided I'd better poison her. Then I realized my husband would find out, so I decided better poison him too. And on my way out, I said to the officer, "Is this for real?" "Oh, yes, sir. Husband was 3 months on life support. He's got permanent brain damage. She's just angry about the length of her sentence." I thought, you have got to be a character in a future book. And I was thinking about this, and in fact, she did end up becoming the central character in Love You Dead in my latest book. I kind of down-aged her more in my book and made her more glam. But I was trying to think of a kind of way in, and in over half of Agatha Christie's novels, women are poisoners. Far more women are poisoners than men. Men tend to be much more brutal and physically brutal. Women are more subtle. And I was thinking about this, and I was spending a day at the Professional Standards Department at Fulham Police Headquarters. And Professional Standards is the department every force have, which basically where they police themselves. And I was walking across this huge open-plan detective's room, and I saw this very plump detective sitting at his desk, stomach bulging out like that, and two huge tins of Quality Street chocolates. So I couldn't help it. I stopped. I said, "You like your chockies, do you?" He said, "No, there's not chocolates in these. This is food for me poisonous frogs." He said, "I'll collect poison dart frogs." I said, "Tell me more." So he very proudly started showing me his poison dart frogs. They're known as poison arrow or poison dart frogs. They come from South America. And they're the creatures that they poison the tips of arrows with. And it's probably the world's most deadly creature. I did learn from him an interesting definition. I wonder how many of you know the difference between poisonous and venomous. Anybody know the difference, poisonous, venomous? Poisonous is something you eat. Venomous is something you, touch or that bites you. So I said, "Oh, this could be really interesting for my next book." He said, "Oh, no." He said, "The problem is," he said, "if you take them out of South America, they don't eat the grubs they get there. They lose their toxicity." He said, "It wouldn't be any good for a murder weapon." He said, "But have you thought about snakes?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh, saw scale viper. That kills 54,000 people every year in India. Bites you, you've got 2 hours to get the antidote or you're dead." I said, "Where do I learn about these?" He said, "Well, there's an exhibition of poisonous snakes twice a year in Houten in Holland." He said, "If you're quick," he said, "there's one week after next." So 2 weeks later, I found myself on a plane to Holland, and I went to this, I thought I'd go into a sort of tatty little shed and find a bunch of weirdos. I was at an exhibition the size of Olympia, full of, and I'm not good with creepy crawlies at all, every kind of spider you can imagine, every kind of snake, every kind of scorpion. I actually was talking to a guy on a scorpion stand, and he said, "Put your hand up." And he put this Arabian flat rock scorpion in my hand. I'm standing there going, "Nice scorpion." Thinking, sometimes in research, you maybe go a little bit too far. So anyhow, in Love You Dead, I ended up becoming something of an expert on venomous creatures. I always enjoy talking to criminals. And another character in Love You Dead is a career burglar. Now, I'm going to give you I know that post-Brexit, things are looking all a bit dodgy. So I'm going to give you all a tip to give you free groceries for the rest of your life. I asked the governor of Lewis Prison if he had a career burglar that I could talk to. I wanted to know how a burglar goes about burgling for a character in this book. And he arranged me to meet this career burglar who had 176 previous convictions. I asked him how he started. I had an hour and a half with him in an interview room, and I said to him, "What can I do for you, mate?" He was 42, looked about 60, because prison ages people. He said, what I'd like to know is, how did you begin burgling? How does it all work? He said, I started when I was 15. He grew up on a sink estate in Brighton. He said, first place I burgled was a neighbor's house. So I got 2 years in an approved school. And I realized when I came out, you're going to get the same amount of time if you do a poor house or a posh house. So I decided to do posh houses. He said, the problem is I'm not very good. I do get caught a lot. He said, what you do is you always leave a back door, back window, patio door open, so if the owners turn up or the law turn up, you can leg it. So I was doing this house in Dyke Road Avenue in Brighton in November. It was dark. And I opened the patio doors, and halfway through it, and the owners turned up. Right, so I legged it out the back. I didn't realize they had a swimming pool. I said, when you're out of prison, what do you do for money? He said, they give you about £50. He said, and don't go very far. He said, I've worked out this really good scheme. Now, here's the tip, everyone. He said, what I do is I go to a big superstore like Tesco, Asda. I stand outside. I wait till someone comes out with a really laden trolley and they throw their receipt in the bin. I'll get the receipt out. I'll get a trolley, I'll go in, I'll match everything to the receipt. I did tell this to the whole management team of Tesco, and their faces dropped. In addition to Love You Dead, this year I had my first non-fiction book published, which I co-wrote with Graham Bartlett, who was the commander of Brighton and Hove Police. And the book's called Death Comes Knocking, Policing Roy Grace's Brighton. And it's told from his perspective as a senior police officer. But it gave us an opportunity to go around meeting a number of villains that have lived in and around Brighton over the years. And they ranged from Brighton's worst ever murderer, a guy called Paul Teed, who in 1985 decided to move his inheritance forward a few years by bludgeoning to death his father, stepmother, and 13-year-old brother with a baseball bat, and very nearly got away with it. And we met him in a pub in York. He's just been released from prison for the second time. And a very dark character. And then we met someone who I actually had to admire, a guy called Dave Henty. And Henty was, again, brought up on a sink estate in Brighton. And his father was a career burglar and used to send him out burgling from the age of 12. He had a talent for art. And when he was 18, he was on a car ferry coming back from Ireland. And he overheard two customs officers talking about how difficult it was to detect forged Irish logbooks. So he saw a business opportunity and went into business forging Irish logbooks, then tax discs, and then passports. And he had a wonderful business going. He was making a lot of money. He bought a beautiful terraced house in the middle of Brighton, put a deposit on a castle in Scotland, and was selling forged passports at £1,000 each to, at the time of the Hong Kong handover about 25 years ago. And everything was going brilliantly well. He had a team of five of them, and they were binding, printing. One problem, he couldn't spell. Her Britannic Majesty was spelt with one N, and Majesty was a G instead of a J. And everything is going wonderfully until Graham Bartlett, who I co-wrote the book with, kicks his front door in with five detectives and arrests him, puts him away for 5 years. In prison, he learns how to paint and comes out and finds he's got a real talent for forging Modigliani, Van Gogh, and Lowry. Starts a very lucrative business doing that to the point where eBay ban him. And he now decides, okay, he'll do them Van Gogh as by Dave Henty. And he's got a huge celebrity clientele. Now, Chris Evans has got a couple of his pictures that he paid 4,000 quid for. Anyway, Graham Bartlett contacted him and said, could we meet with him? And he invited us for lunch. And this is a real old-school villain. Bearing in mind that the last time he saw Graham Bartlett, he kicked his front door in and arrested him and then was giving evidence in the dock against him. He hasn't seen him for 20, 23 years. Graham, mate, great to see you. How are you? Also in the book, we feature probably the world's most unsuccessful bank robber, a guy called Gus Jiggers, who was living in London. I decided to come down to Brighton to rob a bank because nobody would know him in Brighton. So he brought his bicycle down on the train and, busy lunchtime, joined the queue at a Lloyds Bank in North Street in Brighton and dutifully gets to the front and pulls out a gun, says to the teller, give me all your cash. She wasn't that worried because she could see he hadn't taken the stopper out of the front of the toy gun. She said, we've had a bit of a run on banknotes. Would coins be okay? Empties her sandwiches out of her lunchbox, puts coins in, and Graham Bartlett said by the time he and the rest of the police got there, there were five customers lying on top of this guy on the ground. And he had a rucksack with him with a lump in it. And later, when they looked in the rucksack, it contained a bicycle saddle. And he chained his bike up to the railings outside. And when they were interviewing him later, Graham said, we said to him, you know, why did you take your bicycle saddle? He said, well, I heard Brighton's a hotbed of crime. You know, they say there's a book inside everyone, whether printed or electronic. And I think the following illustrates that there might well be, but not necessarily a book that everyone else is going to want to read. There's an award every year called the Edward Bulwer-Lytton to the author of the worst possible opening line of a book submitted to a publisher. I thought I'd just share a few of my favorites with you. As a scientist, Throckmorton knew that if he were ever to break wind in the echo chamber, he would never hear the end of it. She strutted into my office wearing a dress that clung to her like cling film to a sloppily butchered pork knuckle. Bone and sinew jutting and lurching asymmetrically beneath its folds, the tightness exaggerating the granularity of the suet, and causing what little palatable meat there was to sweat. Its transparency, the thief of imagination. The shark circled the leaking life raft like a pack of rabid personal injury attorneys at a five-car pileup. And Clarence could just taste the fear, which tasted like chicken, and wondered morbidly if he too might taste like chicken. And for every budding writer in this room or out there, this is a must. As his small boat scudded before a brisk breeze under a sapphire sky, dappled with cerulean clouds with indigo bases, through cobalt seas that deepened to navy nearer the boat and faded to azure at the horizon, Ian was at a loss as to why he felt blue. I'll just finish before we take questions with a short reading from Love You Dead. I think it's kind of easiest without giving too much away just to start at the beginning. I won't go through quite to the end. So it's chapter one, it's February. Two lovers peered out of the hotel bedroom windows, smiling with glee, but each for a very different reason. The heavy snowfall that had been forecast for almost a week had finally arrived overnight, and fat, thick flakes of the white stuff were still tumbling down this morning. A few cars, chains clanking, slithered up the narrow mountain road, and others, parked outside the hotels, were now large white mounds. Everyone in the smart French ski resort of Courchevel 1850 was relieved. The resort managers, the hoteliers, the restaurateurs, the saisonniers, the ski rental shops, the lift companies, and all the others who relied on the ski season for much of their livelihood. And most importantly of all, the winter sporters themselves. After days of blue skies, searing sunshine and melting snow, which meant treacherous ice in the mornings and slush and exposed rocks in the afternoons, finally the skiers and snowboarders, who'd paid top money for their precious annual few days on the slopes, now had great conditions to look forward to. As Jodie Bentley and her elderly American fiancé, Walt, put on their skis outside the boot room entrance of the Shabby Show Hotel, the falling snow tickled their faces beneath their helmets and visors. Although a seasoned skiing and powder hound, this was the financier's first time skiing in Europe, and he'd been relying all week on his much younger fiancée, who seemed to know the resort like the back of her hand. They skied down carefully in poor visibility to the Biolay lift, just a couple of minutes below the hotel. Walt pulled down the safety bar, then they settled back, snug in their cozy outfits, for the 7 minutes it took the lift to carry them to the top. As they alighted, the wind was blowing fiercely, and without hanging around, Jodie led the way down an easy red. They removed their skis, and Walt, despite suffering from a prolapsed disc, insisted on carrying Jodie's skis as well as his own up the ramp to the lift. As a red 8-seater gondola came slowly round, he jammed their skis into two of the outside holders, then followed her in. They sat down and pushed up their visors, and were followed by another couple. A moment just before the door closed, a short man in his 50s climbed in after them, wearing a smart spider ski outfit. "Bonjour," he said in bad French accent, then added, "Hope you don't mind my joining you." He settled down opposite them as the gondola lurched forward. "Not at all," Walt said. Jodie smiled politely. The other two strangers, both busy texting on their phones, said nothing.
"Ah, bien, vous parlez anglais."
The stranger unclipped his helmet and removed it for an instant to scratch the top of his bald head.
"Americans?"
he said, pulling off his gloves, then removing a tissue from his pocket and starting to wipe his glasses.
I'm from California, but my fiancé is a Brit," Walt said amicably. "Oh, jolly good, beastly weather. Powder on top, should be to die for," the man said.
Jodie smiled politely. "Where are you from?" she asked.
"Oh, the South, Brighton," the stranger replied.
"Good Lord, what a coincidence. So am I," Jodie said.
"Small world," he muttered, and suddenly looked uncomfortable.
So what line of business are you in?" Walt asked him.
"Oh, medical world, just recently retired, moved to France. Yourselves?"
"Oh, I got a group of investment trusts," the American replied. I was a legal secretary," Jodie said. As a small gondola climbed, rocked by the wind, the snow was turning into a blizzard and the visibility deteriorating by the minute. Walt put his arm around Jodie and hugged her. "Maybe we shouldn't go too high this morning, hon. It's going to be very windy at the top."
"The powder is going to be awesome up there," she replied. "And there won't be too many people this early. There's some fabulous runs, trust me."
"Oh, absolutely," the Englishman said. "Trust your beautiful young lady. And the forecast is improving." As the gondola reached the first stage, he waited politely for them to alight. "Nice meeting you," he said. "Bye for now." With Walt insisting again on carrying Jodie's skis, they trudged the short distance to the cable car. Normally jam-packed with skiers, this morning the huge cabin was almost empty. Along with themselves, there was just a few diehards, some boarders in their baggy outfits, two rugged-looking bearded men in bobble hats who were sharing swigs from a hip flask, and a small assortment of other skiers, one wearing a GoPro. Walt raised his visor and smiled at Jodie.
She raised hers and smiled back. He removed a glove, jamming it between his skis, produced a chocolate bar from his breast pocket, and offered it to her. I'm fine, thanks. Still stuffed from breakfast. The cable car rocked in the wind and swayed alarmingly, causing everyone to shriek. Some out of fear, others for fun. You know, maybe we should get a coffee at the top and wait to see if the visibility improves. Oh, let's do a couple of runs first, my love, she replied. We'll find some fresh powder before it gets ruined by other skiers. He shrugged. Okay, but he didn't sound particularly enthusiastic. He stared at her for some moments. You know, he said, you're incredible. Not many people can look beautiful in a helmet and visor, but you do. And you look every inch my handsome prince, she replied. He tried to kiss her, but the top of his helmet bashed against her visor. She giggled, then leaned closer to him and whispered, too bad there's other people here. She ran a gloved hand down his crutch. He squirmed. Jeez, you're making me horny. You make me horny all the time. He grinned, then looked serious again and a tad nervous, peering through a window into the blizzard. As the car yawed in the wind and swung, almost throwing him off balance. You have your cell with you, hun? He asked. Yes. You know, just in case we lose each other in this whiteout. We won't. He patted his chest and frowned, patted it again, then tugged open another zipper. I can't believe it. How stupid. I must have left mine back in the room. I'm sure I saw you put it in your top right-hand pocket before we left. He checked all over again. God damn it, must have fallen out somewhere. Maybe when we were putting our skis on. We're going to stay close, darling, in case we do get separated. Then plan B is we both ski back down to the Croisette and meet there. Just follow the signs for Courcheval 1850. You know, maybe we should ski back down and go check my phone's not lying in the snow outside the hotel. Someone will find it if it is, darling. No one's going to steal it. Listen, we better go back down. I need it. I have a couple of important calls to make this afternoon. Okay, she said. Sure, fine. We'll ski fast. 5 minutes later, the cable car slowed right down and a shadow loomed ahead. The car rocked from side to side, bumping against the sides of the station, slowly sliding in before stopping. Then the doors opened, and they stepped out in their heavy ski boots onto the gridded metal walkway. They shuffled along it, then carefully down the steps and out into the ferocious blizzard, their faces stinging from snow as hard as hailstones. They could hardly see a few feet in front of them, and the group ahead, ducking down and clipping into their boards, were already little more than shadowy silhouettes. As they stood beside a sign, mostly obscured with snow, Walt laid their skis down on the ground, kicked the ice away from the bottom of his boots to make extra sure there were no lumps of snow stuck there, then stepped into his bindings. As the silhouettes began to move away, Jody said, hang on a sec, darling, I need to clean my visor. Walt waited, turning his face away from the wind as best he could. This is horrible! He had to shout to make his voice heard. We're almost at the highest point in the resort, she said. As soon as we get off this ridge, we'll be out of the wind. I hope you're right. Maybe we should start with something easy. Is there a blue run back down? I don't fancy anything too challenging in this goddamn visibility. There is, darling. It's lovely. There's one tiny steep bit to get into it. Then it'll be a glorious cruise. It's my favorite run. He watched the last of the silhouettes disappearing as Jody pulled her gloves back on then stepped into her skis. Ready? Uh-huh. She pointed to the right. We go down there. Are you sure? Everyone else has gone that way. He pointed in the direction the others who had been in the cable car with them had taken. You want the hardcore black run or a gentle blue? Blue, he said emphatically. That crazy lot have all taken the black, she said. She glanced over her shoulder and could just make out the cable car leaving the station for its return journey. It'd be a good 15 minutes before the next load of skiers arrived. Right now, they were alone. Blue, she said, are you sure? I'm sure you could cope with the black. Not in this visibility. Then we go this way, she said. I can't see any sign pointing this way, hon. There must be a signpost up here, surely. With one ski pole, she began to brush away the fresh powder snow from the ground beside her. After a few moments, tracks were revealed beneath it, frozen into the cruddy, icy surface. See?
she said. He peered at them. They led straight ahead for a couple of yards before disappearing into the swirling white blizzard. Looking relieved, he smiled. Clever girl, I'll follow you. No, you go first, in case you fall over. I can help you up. Just follow the tracks. Bend your knees and brace yourself, because the first 50 yards or so are a bit steep. Then it levels out. Just let yourself go. She shot an anxious glance around her to make absolutely sure no one was watching. Okay, he said with a sudden burst of enthusiasm. Here goes. Yee-haw! He launched himself forward on his poles, like a racer, out of the gate, and whooped again. Yee-haw! Then his voice turned into a terrible scream for just one fleeting second before it was swallowed by the wind, then silence. Jody turned round, then pushing with her poles, headed off in the direction all the other skiers had taken, oblivious to the wind and the stinging snow on her cheeks.
Not only dramatic tension, but it takes you away from the 45-degree heat of a Norwich evening a little bit, doesn't it? I'm conscious you're all probably melting. In fact, three people at the back actually have. But we have a few minutes for questions, if you'd like to ask Peter anything about life, art, crime. Who's going to be the brave person who'd like to start us off?
Hello, Peter. I've read all of your Roy Grace books, and one of the things I'd like to ask is, have you got something fairly nasty lined up for Caspian Pugh?
Thank you. Have I got something nasty for Caspian Pugh? For those of you who don't know my books, Caspian Pugh is Roy Grace's new assistant chief constable boss, who is an extremely unpleasant character, and Roy, to his eternal regret, saved his life about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. I do actually have something in mind for him, yes. Possibly in a ski resort, possibly involving a snake.
Can I ask, when you put the plot together, and do you structure it so that you've got the ending in mind the whole way through, or do you sometimes shift it around?
The way I like to work, and I think so many writers work in different ways, but I always like to know the ending. I kind of liken it to getting in a car. But I think if you get in your car, you're going to have some idea of where you're going, whether it's the Tesco down the road or John O'Groats. To me, it's like a roadmap. But I'm a great believer also in spontaneity. I love something that pops in my head at 7 o'clock in the evening as I'm having my second vodka martini that wasn't there 10 seconds earlier. So I do a mixture of planning and spontaneity. I plan the first 20% of a book out in quite a lot of detail, and key high points of the story, and always the ending. But I would say, and probably what tends to happen is, as I get into a book, the story shifts very often. And I love that when that happens. I think if you don't surprise yourself, you're not going to surprise your readers. But again, it's a very personal thing. I mean, someone like Jeffrey Deaver writes a 350-page outline, but it works for him. I know other writers who don't. I think Lee Child doesn't plan at all; he just starts writing. But what works best for me is a fair degree of planning, and certainly the really kind of key big scenes. I guess it comes from my movie making days, where films tend to have kind of big set piece scenes, and I tend to write very much with those in mind.
Good evening. Hello. What are you reading at the moment, please, from a pleasure perspective?
Well, when I'm writing, I tend to avoid reading fiction. I tend to read non-fiction much more. But books that I've read and really loved in the last year, I binge read on holiday. I guess my two favorite books of the last year were I Let You Go by Claire McIntosh, which I gave a quote for. I thought it was very clever. And she's an ex-police officer. gets it right. A book called Alex by a French writer called Pierre Lemaitre. I like Michael Connelly a lot as well. And I also like Linwood Barclay, the Canadian writer. I think he's a really, really good writer. I enjoy them a lot. And I'm always getting sent new books. I'm always looking for... What I love is reading a book and thinking, bugger, wish I'd written that. Those are the moments when I'm really loving a book.
Can I just ask if you've got any top tips for budding crime fiction writers?
Top tips for budding crime fiction writers? Okay, I've recently launched my own YouTube channel, PJTV. You can it's very easy to get it. It's on my website, peterjames.com/YouTube. And I'm putting up regular writing tips on that. In fact, I'm going to be eventually putting up a whole kind of writing, creative writing seminar, very much aimed at crime, mystery, thriller. Laura and I are kind of running it together and putting it up, constant tips almost every week. I've done a few bizarre ones. I've done one writing tip on a pedalo, one on a paddleboard. So I'm doing them in kind of funky places just to kind of make it a bit of fun. But they're all kind of very serious points. And I've taught creative writing for a number of years down in Sussex. And I have loads and loads of advice for writers. I think that you can't teach someone to write. I think writing is something that is either innately in you or not, but what you can do is help somebody who's got the talent through giving tips. My number one tip to any prospective writer is to read. And I mean that seriously. It's like, you know, if you wanted to be a car mechanic, what you do is you take an engine apart and put it back together. And I'm a great believer. I would take the books that I really love, that have been big bestsellers, and deconstruct them. You know, how did Stephen King make me so gripped by The Shining? You know, what made me love Brighton Rock so much? And I think writing is a craft, and never be afraid to treat it as a craft. You know, if you're a carpenter and you're making light wooden bedside lamps, the 20th one you make is going to be better than the first. And I think we all learn as we go along, but the best place to learn from is our peers.
Maybe time for a couple more questions.
I'm a great fan of your Roy Grace.
Thank you.
Having been in the profession.
Were you? What?
But what intrigues me, we see the regular characters come up in that series. Do they ever take over? Do they always do as you want them to?
No, they don't. I mean, my favorite characters outside of Roy Grace is Norman Potting. And honestly, I get a letter, I think, email once a week from a police officer somewhere in the UK saying, I think we've got Norman in our office. He is my utterly politically incorrect detective sergeant, old school, you know, racist, homophobic, always in trouble for his mouth. But I introduced him really as a kind of bit of a joke in the second book in Looking Good Dead. And he's kind of risen, and he comes into his own in Love You Dead. He has actually a major role to play in it. Oh, brilliant, thank you. I've got a new stage play coming on in the new year, Not Dead Enough, which is the third book. He's not unfortunately in that, but he's going to be in a future stage play as well.
One more question.
I saw a gentleman at the back too over there.
Two more questions then.
Do you have any bad writing habits? Bad habits?
Do I have any bad habits? My wife will be able to answer those. Who was it who once said, write drunk, edit sober? I mean, my favorite writing time, everyone has their own writing time, but from my days when I was working full-time in film and television, I made my kind of writing time in the evening. So I guess my bad habit is my writing time, which is like 6 till 9:30 at night, and then supper on a tray watching some rubbish on television, or good rubbish sometimes. And I like a drink when I'm writing. You know, I'll have a vodka martini and cigar and get in a zone. I love it. It's my treat time. I really love writing. And I review what I wrote in the morning and hope I didn't get too smashed the night before. But I'm also, I think all of us who write, are there any other full-time writers in the room? We are all very distracted so easily. And the easiest thing in the world is to not write. You know, I'll be writing, and in fact, Laura recently made me turn off the notifications for Twitter and email, because I'd be writing, and I'd say, oh, a tweet's coming, have a look at that. And 10 minutes later, I've gone back to what I'm writing, or you know, you see an email pop in. So I think being distracted is one bad habit I have. And the other is addiction to was Maltesers, and it's now peanut M&Ms.
Where was your last question, Peter?
Is that gentleman over there? And
as far away as possible.
Yes, thank you. The double header, really. The first part of it is, do you consider yourself a frustrated detective? And secondly, do you see a natural progression and end to the Roy Grace series?
Let me answer the second. Thank you, everyone. No way. When I created Wright, I made a conscious decision. I think, you know, Ian Rankin, and I really like Ian's work and the Rebus books. I think they're fantastic. You know, he made that decision. He writes a book a year. So Rebus got a year older and eventually hit retirement age. Luckily for him, retirement age in Scotland then got extended. And I play with time, I'm 100 pages from the end of my 13th Roy Grace novel. Don't know why I should be writing now, actually. And he's only aged 2 years in those 13 books, because what I've done is almost every book picks up within a few days or a few weeks after the last one. So I move them forward culturally a year in time. So I'm playing a little bit with time. So Roy is now coming up to his 41st birthday, 13 books on. So I've got plenty of time with him. And as long as lovely people like you are enjoying the books, I have huge fun writing them. I really love going out with the police, you know, going out next week on a night with traffic. And I found it fascinating talking to police officers all the time. As I'm sure you, this gentleman here, was in the force. I do think it's an extraordinary career. I've forgotten the first part, sorry. Well, am I a frustrated detective? I have given some help to the Sussex Police over the years. Russia is one of my big territories. For some reason, I'm a rock star there. I'm currently number one and number four in Russia at the moment, which is interesting. But I did go about 3 years ago, a DI in Sussex. They had somebody who they thought had died in Moscow and was in a mortuary and couldn't get identified. So I actually took all the papers over and spent some time with the police there and actually established it wasn't that person. I always wonder, I'm often asked, knowing what I know now, would I have gone into the police? And the one thing that makes me dubious is whether I'd be brave enough. You know, I've been quite scared a number of times when I've been with the police, at 2 o'clock in the morning, walking up to a parked car where there's a MET marker on an armed robber owning the car. But I have done some heroic things. I was... A few years back, 10 o'clock at night, in one of Brighton's rough estates up in White Hawk, I was with a young sergeant and a very young Indian policewoman officer, her first week out of probation. And there were 10 youths walking down the street, all necking bottles. And it's a criminal offence in Brighton and Hove to have an open bottle of alcohol on the street. And the two officers got out of the car, so I get out too. And I wear whatever I'm given. And sometimes it's usually a yellow jacket. Sometimes it's got police. Sometimes it's got observer on it. But I've got my jacket on, and I'm standing making notes. And this is really turning ugly. One of the guys is shouting racist remarks at her. I'm not having my bottle taken off by a fucking... And I can see the sergeant's radioing for backup, but backup could take 10, 20 minutes in that location at that time of night. And I can see this is turning out, it's going to be a fight. So I'm thinking, right, do I run? Do I get back in the car and shut the door? And I thought, well, the only way I can keep face is I'm going to have to get stuck in too. And I'm standing there like this, with this little coat on. And I'm looking around for the smallest one. I think I'll hit. I think I'll have my fight with him. And suddenly, this one of them points at him and says, "Who the fuck's he?" And the sergeant says, quick as a flash, "He's with the FBI." They all handed over their bottles and. I think they thought I had a gun in there. So, you know, respect.
Thanks for listening. This is the first of many podcasts from the Noir Ridge Crime Writing Festival, so be sure to follow us on SoundCloud or subscribe via your favourite podcast app so that you don't miss anything. You can send us questions on Twitter at Writers Centre and find out more about what we do around the UK on our website at writerscentrenorwich.org.uk.